My name is Clancy Amos London. I'm an alcoholic. If you can't do it in synchronization with the others, kid, don't do it. I don't want to break your heart, but I'm not going to talk an awfully long time. But I'm very pleased to be here tonight. I'm pleased to participate in any function of AA. I'm pleased that to be present at the central office thing we do each summer out here in the wilds of Northridge. And I'm especially pleased because we are celebrating the 50th birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is really something because AA is, I'll tell you, the trouble with being a human being, human beings take things for granted. Anything you get, you take it for granted. We take AA for granted. There may be some people who don't, but there wouldn't be much of a large number. Because Alcoholics Anonymous, most anything in your life you take for granted. You take anything that comes along, if it comes along on a regular basis. I know that when I first came to AA, I took it for granted and rejected it. And I thought, a bunch of old fuddy-duddies. And this was when AA was only 15 years old. And I thought it had been there forever because it was there when I got there. And so it seems like it's been there forever. And I'm sure that some of you who are new tonight think, well, Jesus, 50 years, it's been here forever. But it's a hard thing to remember that there have been drunks as long as people have been fermenting alcohol. And that goes back before the Bible. And there's been people with our illness, and there's never any reason to think that there's any less percentage of people who are alcoholics than there are now. But that means like 6 or 7% of people who drank, as far back as you can look in history, were tormented and bothered and driven and ridiculed by their peers and ridiculed by the establishment and put down and hidden by embarrassed families and sent away, and no one ever had the slightest idea what was going on. Now you think, well, this all changed 50 years ago, but it didn't. It kept that way for a long time after that, because a few little guys sober clinging together like survivors on a life raft in two towns in Ohio and New York didn't change that situation. And the saddest thing is today we know there's an answer, and it works very effectively for most every alcoholic. And yet, probably 98% or more of alcoholics will die drunk. A number of people in this room tonight will die drunk. Maybe me, maybe you. Don't know who. But that's just the way it is because of the nature of the illness. Because we take this for granted. Now, I'm not laying any finger on you. I'm laying it on me. We all take it for granted. It becomes, sometimes AA becomes just a social hour. Sometimes you go to a meeting to cruise. Sometimes you just go down there and see what's going on. Sometimes you, well, I'm tired or I got a little problem. I don't want to go to AA, as though it were a bridge club where if you have a problem, you don't attend. And it really is kind of a funny and tragic thing because this is the single greatest thing that's ever happened to people like to you and me in the history of mankind. The only problem is the people it's happening to take it for granted. Yeah, so what? Big deal. Big nothing. And I'll tell you, some of you may or may not be familiar with it. I've always kind of liked to, because I'm kind of a history buff, I've read a number of things about the founding of AA that go take it a little bit deeper than they have in our book, or AA Comes of Age, or even the new biography on Bill Wilson. There are some other books written by other people. And if you ever saw the weird chain of coincidences that enable us to sit in this room today, it sends a shiver down your spine. If any one of those coincidences wouldn't have happened, you and I most likely would be, I'm not saying dead or in insane asylums or jail. Wherever we would be in a place where there's no hope and we would be put down and no one would have anything to do with it. And there would be no place to go. Just a little couple minutes of background. In 1912, there was a guy named Frank Buckman. He was a minister. And he was an Episcopalian priest, as they call it. And he felt that Christianity was getting away from its early principles. And he wanted to make it like the real old-timers were at the time of Christ. So he started a movement called the First Century Christian Association. In other words, he wanted to get a group of enthusiasts who would not only would go to sit there in church on Sunday, but do something during the week. And over a period of time, that got to be known as the Oxford Group. And these people, mostly Episcopalians, mostly well-to-do people, would get together and discuss their lives and discuss deep spiritual problems they had with one another, and there were chapters in every city. And as it most troubled people who happened to be ever having done well got some, a lot of them got to the Oxford Group. There was a guy in a doctor in Ohio. He'd been going to the Oxford Group for several years. He went for his drinking problem, but he never talked much about his drinking because the Oxford Group didn't have much understanding of drinking. They were there for spiritual problems. And so he became quite an authority on spiritual matters. He became a leader of the discussions on spiritual matters, except that he kept getting drunk. But he didn't get drunk at the meeting, so he didn't lose his position. There was another well-to-do guy in New York who had never heard of the Oxford Group, and his name was Roland. And he was from a lot of money, and his family had, they could do anything to try to help him. They had him in institutions and hospitals and therapies, and finally they gave it their best shot. In Europe at that time, there were two great practitioners of the early art of psychoanalysis and psychiatry. One was Dr. Freud, and his student, who had become a rebel, Dr. Jung. There were two different schools. The psychiatry was just like AA. As soon as you teach a guy something, he shakes his fist at you. And Dr. Jung was in the ascendancy in 1930. So they took a lot of dough, and they sent their boy, Roland, to see Dr. Jung. And he sat and talked to Dr. Jung at length and told him about this terrible drinking problem, and he waited for an answer. And what Dr. Jung told him was not very pleasant. He said, "Sir, I am sorry to tell you this, but there is no help for your problem. You are what is known as a dipsomaniac. There is no known therapy. I am afraid you must reconcile yourself to a life of increasing agony and eventually an alcoholic death." He said, "I'd give anything if that weren't the case. But I know of no help in any therapy I have ever heard of." Now, this is 1930. I was alive then. I mean, this is not very long ago. There was no known help in the world for people like you and me, anywhere. There were a lot of people who treated alcoholics. There were things where they had aversion treatments. They called it the Keeley cure. That was going, but it never worked. Nothing ever worked. He said, "The only thing I can tell you, Roland, is that the only cures I've ever seen for dipsomania is that some people have been saved by an evangelical religious experience. But that's something you can't prescribe, and that's something I can't tell you how to get. It just happened." So Roland came home without any hope. And he looked around, and somebody, he said, "I gotta find an evangelical religious experience. Where the hell am I gonna find it?" And his minister said, "I don't know if it'll help, but there's this First Century Christian Association who try to help one another, and they may be able to help you. I don't know anybody else that can. No church can." So he went to that. And he had something that happened to him that we talk about here, but and sometimes it happens to us, but it's one of the great helps for any alcoholic to seek help. It is called deflation at depth. He had lost hope. There was no way he could get better. He was no longer working on control. It was just a matter of, can you die with dignity? And so he got in there, and his ego wasn't in the way because he knew he couldn't get well anyway. So he did these things, and somehow he stayed sober. And he stayed very active. He went to this all the time. And his, like Chuck C. used to say, he was surrendered when he got here, which enabled him to stay sober. Now, he went home to visit his folks, where he grew up in a little town in Vermont, 2 or 3 years later, and he was sober. And he was telling some of his friends about it. And while he was there, by a remarkable coincidence, a childhood friend of his, on one of his drunks, had just driven his car into a guy's living room. And they were going to send him away. And he thought, well, maybe this remarkable religious experience will help for him. If he would have been there 2 days later, you and I would be dead. But he was there that day when the guy was arrested. And he went down to the judge, who was another friend of his, and he said, Judge, I know this guy is a real bad dipsomaniac. But I've got something in going in New York City that I think will help him. I will get him out of town if you will release him to me. And the judge says, okay, but if he ever comes back here, he's gone. So he took him to New York City. And he got him into the First Century Christian Association, also known as the Oxford Movement. And they sat around and talked. And about a year later, here's another funny coincidence. These two guys were from a little town in Vermont. The guy that had run his car drunkenly into somebody's living room said, hey, you know, there's another guy from our little hometown here in New York. Now, I understand he's a real bad one. His name is Bill Wilson. Maybe I'll go over and talk to him. And so he found Bill Wilson, a drunken ex-stockbroker who was down and out, and his wife was working in the store to support him. And he went over to him, and Bill later wrote he couldn't believe his eyes when he saw his drinking friend come in sober. Not that he was wonderful, he was sober. And he talked to Bill. And Bill didn't want to hear about this God crap. And so he left, and Bill got drunk. But they got together again. And finally they got Bill going to the First Century Christian Association, also known as the Oxford Movement. And he stayed sober for a while. And then he got drunk. Because that happened a lot in the First Century Christian Association. When alcoholics came there, it was nice, but they couldn't relate. They could stay sober a while. Roland was the only one that was staying sober. He stayed sober because he was surrendered by the time he got there. But he went back, came off this terrible drunk. He was in town's hospital. And they had told him, you're going to have some sort of a religious evangelical experience. That's what they preach. That's all he knew. And he couldn't get it. And as most of you remember reading about, one morning he woke up and he just knew he was going to die drunk, and he couldn't help himself and everything. And he said, oh God, what could I do? And he had what is known as a religious experience, one that has not been given to very many people. That's why in our 12 steps it talks about spiritual awakenings, the sort of thing that come gradually. But he said his room was like, is filled with a white, big white light, and there was almost like a wind in his ears, and he couldn't believe it. And when that went away, he felt, I am going to stay sober and help other people stay sober. And he got really into this Oxford Movement now, and he talked about his drinking, but he didn't get along very well in the Oxford Movement because he was interested in drunks. And instead of sitting with the good people talking about spiritual values, he would take drunks out and buy them coffee and talk about his experience. And he took people home, and he wasn't working. His wife was going to work every day in the May Company, working behind a counter, and he was sitting home with his drunk, trying to convey a message. And none of the drunks ever stayed sober. They would steal. Sometimes they stole stuff out of his house and sold it for wine. On and on. And his wife, he got very discouraged. And after a number of months, he told his wife, he said, you know, what I thought was a spiritual experience probably wasn't. It probably was a psychotic experience. Whatever I'm doing isn't working. I guess I've been kidding myself. And this was after you're sober almost a year. And his wife said, no, Bill, you're missing the point. It is working because this is the first time in your life you have ever stayed sober a year. Maybe the whole point of it is to help somebody else. So he kept going. So then some guys got in touch with him. They knew he was sober. They were going to give him one chance. There was a little machine tool company out in Akron, Ohio, and some guys in New York had 40% of the stock. Anyway, because we can take over this place and make a big deal. Don't blow it, for Christ's sake. Get those proxies. And this is the first time he'd had a decent job since he was sober. And he went out to Akron, Ohio, and unfortunately, The guys in Akron heard that this bunch in New York were sending one of their high binders, and they bought up all the proxies. So after he was there about 3 or 4 days, they said they had the vote, and he was out. And he barely had money in his pocket to go home to report another failure, another loss. If he wouldn't have his room paid up, he wouldn't have no place to stay that night. And he walked into the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel. I think about this because I've been in that lobby and I've retraced the steps for kind of a psychic phenomenon. And over there, about 40 feet from the door, is a very inviting door. It's closed now. It's been closed down, turned into a senior citizen's home. But at that time, a very inviting door. And over it says, cocktail, air conditioned. And this was the middle of, this was May 8th, 1935, May 9th. And he started to go in and get a drink. What does an alcoholic do when you've done everything you can do and everything you touch turns to crap? That's what you do, you drink. Now, there isn't a person in this room who isn't familiar with that. I am so grateful to God that it wasn't me in that position. He started to go. And then he remembered. He had promised these people in the Oxford movement that he would try to get a hold of somebody. He hoped he wouldn't get a hold of anybody too spiritual. He hoped he could get a hold of someone who also had a drinking problem. They were very rare in the Oxford movement. So they had given him... He didn't get it, no, he didn't give him anything. He went to the hotel, phones, and in small town hotels, there's a list of churches and their phone numbers for people of all religions. And he found the Episcopalian minister, because the Episcopalians were most tied into the Oxford movement. And he called him up. He said, I'm from New York, and I'm an Oxford group member. And could you give me the names of some people and phone numbers? I got to get a hold of somebody because I'm in very bad trouble. And so he gave him a list of 10 names to call. And he called the first one. He said, I'm an alcoholic or a drinker from New York, a member of the Oxford movement. Do you know anybody who has a drinking problem I could talk to? And the voice on the other end said, I don't know what your problem is, but I'm seeking spiritual values. Don't use the Oxford movement for your own usage. Click. And he called the second name with the same story. Click. And he called the third name of the 10 he'd got. Click. And he got the fourth name. Click. Hung up on him. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 8. After the 8th one, he thought, this is ridiculous. I'm feeling worse instead of better. And he thought about getting a drink. He thought, no, I'll call the 9th one. So he called the 9th one. And he said, I need an alcoholic to talk to. And the voice on the phone said, well, you certainly have the wrong number. Click. And on that moment, your life and mine hung on about as slim a thread as you could ever believe. And he started to go out of the booth, and he came back. He said, well, I got the 10 names, I'll call the 10th name. And he called the 10th name. And the guy on that end of the line said, no, I know nothing about drinking. But I know a woman who says her doctor is a drunk. And you stay there, I'll have her call you. The guy didn't want to give the strange voice the woman's phone number. So he stood in the phone booth for 20 minutes in that hot, baking day. First in the phone came in. She said, my name is Henrietta Cyberling. I'm with the Cyberling Tire Company family. She said, I have no drinking problem, but I have a doctor that does. Would you like to come out and talk to me? Maybe you can help me. So he got on the bus and rode out to the Cyberling Mansion. Maybe some of you have been there. Enormous mansion. Lovely. Big grounds. I stood and walked around that and thought about that thing. And she met him in the guest house, which was bigger than most houses. And she talked to him. She said, I've called my doctor, but unfortunately, he is drunk. He cannot talk. This was the night before afternoon before Mother's Day. He had come home with a potted plant for his wife, but he was more potted than the plant. The plant was on the table, and he was underneath it. And his wife said, I don't know what we're going to do, but better not have anybody visit him today. So Miss Cyberling said, well, let's try it again tomorrow. So he went back to his hotel, and the next day he came down there, out to the guest house, and Miss Cyberling sent over her chauffeur and picked up this sick, shaking doctor, and they sat down and talked. And later, Dr. Bob used to say, that was the first person I ever talked to who acted like he knew how I felt inside as a drinker. Not spiritual, as a drinker. And they got along. And Dr. Bob said, Bill, you're really a dear person. Now you tell me that you've blown everything in New York. You have to be, there's no place to go. Why don't you come and stay at our house? So Bill called up his wife and said, I'm going to stay at this guy's house. At least I'm staying sober. So he went over to his house and they lived there for 3 weeks. Bill lived there. And at the end of 3 weeks, that was the first time Dr. Bob had been sober in 3 weeks in a long time. And he felt good, and he was a surgeon. And he said, listen, this is great. I want to go to the American Medical Association. Our annual convention is in Atlantic City. There's no way I thought I could go, because I couldn't trust myself. But I can go. Why don't you stay here with my wife and my kids, and I'll go there and tell them a little something what we found. And he got on the train and went to Atlantic City, and nothing was heard from him for several days. Then one morning, Dr. Bob's office nurse called up and said, I don't know if you know it or not, but I was called to the railroad station at 4 o'clock this morning, and some porters carried Doctor off the train drunk, passed out, and I got him in a cab, and I have him sleeping it off. So Bill and Bob's wife went over, and there he was, wiped out again. No hope. And they got him sobered up. And that night he told him some bad news. I have some very intricate surgery tomorrow. I gotta do it. I'm shaking so bad I can't hold a glass of beer, but I've gotta do it. So they put him to bed, and they put cold compresses on his head, and they gave him coffee, and they did everything they could. The next day, they went to the hospital, and Bob said, I'm the only one in this hospital who knows how to do this surgery, but I can't do it. He said, look at my hand. I can't hold the scalpel. So Bill Wilson went down and got him a bottle of beer just to hold his hand still so he could do the surgery. And he gave him a bottle of beer, set him down a little bit, and he did the surgery successfully. And that was June 10th, 1935. That was the last drink Dr. Bob ever had. Bill Wilson never had another drink, and that's the birthday we're celebrating. The day that Bill Wilson got a bottle of beer and gave it to Dr. Bob so he could not kill the patient under his surgical knife. And Bill stayed there for a while, and it was kind of funny. Last year I was down in Texas. I had a chance to sit for a couple hours with Dr. Bob's son, who's now a grown-up. And he's a member of Al-Anon, of all things, for Christ's sake. But I was tolerant. I talked to him. Different at home. I just listen. But it's a funny thing. Talk about taking things for granted. Here in that house, they were taking drunks in, working with them. Same thing that happened. It happened in New York. They'd all get drunk and steal things and shinny down the drain pipe to go get a drink. But their house was all full of guys. And these two dynamic, one dynamic man and one spiritual man, Dr. Bob was a little more sedate, had these people. They're starting the greatest evangelical movement in the 20th century and maybe in all the centuries. And the only thing that kid remembered was, when he was a kid, he really resented those people around there. Every time he came home, there was some sick son of a bitch in the living room. He said, I'd go out on a date. Couldn't ever bring her to my house. Bunch of guys puking. So I used to resent these people. This guy from New York, he seemed to be nice enough, but I knew he was leading my father down the wrong path. That's what you call taking it for granted. But they stayed sober. And they finally found a guy that, they finally came to the conclusion that sitting around talking spiritual matters did not keep people sober. It made them sound good, but it didn't keep them sober. And they came to the conclusion maybe, and they were going to the Oxford movement incessantly in Akron. And the Oxford movement was getting a little tired of them, because the Oxford movement wanted to talk about spiritual values, and they wanted to talk about staying sober. And they got to be kind of a drag around there. And the Oxford movement put him down a little bit. They really did. In fact, in some of the AA literature, in the AA archives, there's a couple letters from people years later saying, forgive us. We didn't know what we were doing. We had no idea what you were doing. It just seemed that you were being disruptive. And they got a guy in the Akron City Hospital, because Dr. Bob knew a nurse there. This is long before Sister Ignatia came along. He knew a nurse. They got their first drunk in there. He stayed sober. And he hated it. His wife came to him and said, his name was Bill D. Said, Bill, they were from the South, and I heard him, a tape of his talk. It's really funny. She came to my room and said, Bill, I've been talking to two men, and they believe they can help you with your drinking. And I said, bullshit. I don't want to talk to no more ministers. But they brought him in there. And they didn't talk to him about ministers. They talked to him about that they used to be the same way. He never even talked. He didn't have to confess. They talked about themselves. And he stayed sober. And little by little grew. And some guys from Cleveland came down. And some of them stayed sober. But I'll tell you something else. We get the feeling that everybody that got touched by this stayed sober. Most of them got drunk again. Most of them died drunk. Most of the early A's died drunk. Because they couldn't surrender. And the guys that were surrendered when they came in, like Bill, couldn't understand why these guys weren't surrendered. And they couldn't understand how he could be surrendered. Dr. Bob, the co-founder of AA, in his later days wrote that every day of his life, year after year, he craved a drink after he was sober. Very few people in AA today have that, but they didn't have the structure. They didn't have the tools to surrender with. And by 1937, they had kind of the Oxford movement. Bill had gone back to New York and started something, and the Oxford movement had pushed these alcoholics out. If you find what you want to do, but stay away from us. And by 1938, they had a few people sober a while, more than they ever thought they could. They had 79 people who'd been sober a year. They had hundreds who were drunk, but 79 who were sober a year. And they thought maybe the best way to get this out is to write a book about it. So Bill decided to write a book and make some dough for the organization. And he wrote this book, and it took him a long time, and he went back into a lot of things, and he went to the Oxford Movement literature. And I'll tell you, you can empathize for him. There weren't very many people in sober New York at that time, maybe 40, 30 or 40. And every time he'd write a part of the book, you'd take it down and read it to them for their criticisms. If you have ever subjected anything to your group for criticisms, that can make you, he used to get so crazy, he'd just hardly stand it. He'd just, well, screw them, you know. But he finally, now, I mentioned this at our meeting a week or so ago, but I want to mention one more time, because it's always interesting to think about. I have always been rather cynical. I'm a writer, and I've been a writer all my life, and I have made my good living writing, and I'm experienced with the written word, I'll tell you. And so anything written that's beautiful doesn't impress me much, because I can write that stuff too. In fact, I wrote an article for The Grapevine in 1953. It's one of the most beautiful articles I've ever had. It's called AA, A Portable Sanctuary. And it talked about how in medieval times people could grasp the door of the cathedral and cry sanctuary, and no one could attack them. And today in AA, we have a sanctuary we can take with us and through spiritual value live in. And it's really beautiful and true. I didn't read it for years because I was drunk by the time it came out, and someone told me about it years later. I said, are you the same Clancy that wrote that beautiful thing about this? Yes, I am. That's a good... Back in 1964 or 65, the editor of The Grapevine asked me to write another article commenting on why that article was insincere. So they ran them both together in, July of 1965, A Portable Sanctuary and then A Portable Sanctuary Revisited. But I'm not much of one to be impressed by written exhortations. And if you are, there's thousands of books. You go to any bookstore or airport, right? There's a section on do it for yourself. I'm okay, you're okay. And on and on and on. Books of inspiration and goodness. And the AA book always struck me that way. I read it first in 1930, 40 at 49. And it's just some more of the same old crap. But I have come over the years, as many people have, once you're sober a while, I have come to believe that this is one of the few inspired pieces of literature that I cannot explain. Because I'll tell you, the man who wrote this book did not know enough to write this book. It had to be some kind of inspiration beyond him. Now, you can write any kind of lot of inspirational books, but the most impossible thing to do is to write a book that is true and will come true. All of the books that you read out there, they're all very nice, but they have no application. It's like reading inspirational literature is very similar, as I've often said, to peeing your pants on a street corner. It serves no lasting purpose, but makes you feel warm while you're doing it. You know. But a few minutes later, another cold wind comes along, and there you are. This book has recovered more alcoholics than anything else in the history of mankind. And the man did not know enough to write it. He had no background in psychology, abnormal psychology, medicine. Everything he wrote was subject to criticism. And they were trying to be democratic, so every idiot just off Skid Row had as much say in it as anybody. And it's just hideous, for Christ's sake. And writing under pressure. He was talking about thinking of how he could put it in words, and he had some Oxford group stuff and other stuff, and racked him. Remember one day he was lying there, and the concept of these steps came to him, putting together a bunch of other things, and he had no idea there were 12. There's no magic number for 12. That's just what came out. And he wrote them down, and he was severely criticized for them by his companion, and on and on. But here was a guy 3 years sober. Now, it's the example I like to talk about. When you're new, being sober 3 years seems like you should have a lot on the ball and you're very wise. By the time you're 3 years sober, you realize you don't have enough to pour pee out of a boot, out of the hole. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just kind of smirk at people 3 years sober. Well, you'll keep coming back. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober for coffee because they can't remember how much cream and sugar you take. Was that two creams and one sugar or one cream? By the time you're 20 years sober, you don't want people 3 years sober left unattended on your property. You know, they're nice, but they're just goofs. And here was a guy 3 years sober that wrote this book. And one of the most impressive things about it, you hear about the 12 promises. All kinds of books are full of those kind of promises. This book is full of promises that most of them had not yet happened to the author. And yet, those promises have come true to thousands and thousands of people, including him eventually. They come true, and then as human beings, we screw them up. Then they come true again, and we screw them up. But they come true. And we will intuitively know how to handle things that used to destroy us, certainly. Everybody does that every day, so it's over very long. Another example I use in our group, but it's certainly true. People say, but God damn it, it says financial insecurity will leave you. No, it never says that. It says fear of financial insecurity will leave you. You can be on your ass, but you have to be afraid of it. But these promises come true, and it goes on and on, all the way through that book. It's the best way, I'll tell you. I read this book many times, and I know about the book. But it was like a new experience about 6 or 7 years ago when we started a book study group. And I read the book for half an hour every night, and we discussed it for an hour. And I was the first reader I read for a couple months, I think. And I couldn't believe it. I'd been reading that book for over 20 years, and I was reading things in there I had never seen before. Because when you read to yourself, you skim. Your eyes just skim if you're a reader. When you read it out loud, you have to make sense out of it. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe how smart that book was. And yet the first time I read it, wasn't that smart at all. But this book gets truer and truer as the years go by in sobriety, whereas most spiritual books get to be just something to throw away in 6 months. This is really phenomenal. So they got the book finally. He sent it out to Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob handed back the bill. A couple little corrections. Now they got to get the thing published. So they found a publishing house that was willing to publish the book They have no name for it either. Bill and a couple others like the name Alcoholics Anonymous because you didn't use their name. But a lot of people, most of the people in AA didn't want to be, well, it was close to, didn't want their names connected with some goddamn thing that said Alcoholics Anonymous. And they voted for the title The Way Out, which sounds good and it doesn't make you look bad. And they had a terrible hassle. People got drunk over that and died. It's funny, but all you have to do is look around and see a resentment starting about alcoholics in the group or two groups shaking their fists at each other, and just it becomes obsession and loses all intellectual sense. It's just obsession. So finally they asked somebody who had a friend in Washington, look at the Library of Congress. And they found out that there were 12 books registered named The Way Out, and none registered Alcoholics Anonymous. So they called the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Very human people. These were not wonderful Christ-like figures. They were fighting for existence, and nobody knew which way they were going. Bill's AA's office was a guy, one of Bill's great early disciples, was a man named Henry P., and he let him use his secretary, a woman named Ruth, and they lived in this little office and answered the mail while Bill's wife worked every day at the May Company. And it's funny how AA goes. By the time 5 years were up, Henry had rebelled against Bill and started his own movement. That's the common phenomenon among alcoholics. They just got to rebel. They got to be, everybody's got to be a goddamn chief. And we all familiar with that. Once you've been sober 20 minutes, you want to... I don't think that's right. And I've done it as much as anybody that ever lived, I'll tell you. But they got a publisher, I believe it was Harper's, to publish this book. And just as they were about to sign the contract, they realized they would get a royalty, but the book would belong to the publisher, because that's the way publishing firms work. You sell them your book, they keep the ownership and give you royalties when they sell copies. And they didn't think it would be good for a group like ours to have somebody else owning our book. So they said, no, we're not going to let you. We'll publish it ourselves. Okay, now we're going to publish it ourselves. No money. So they made up shares of stock and tried to peddle them to people. Can you imagine, for Christ's sake, some idiot comes along. I've got want to put up $25 for a share in a book that's not really named and from an organization that isn't doing very well, and here's your chance to get to the bottom floor. They couldn't sell any stock. They finally got a couple wealthy members who bought a share or two, but you know, hardly. But they finally somehow got some dough. As you, most of you know that story, they went to the Rockefellers for money. The Rockefellers turned them down. But what most people don't know, they turned down AA, but Rockefeller gave Bill Wilson $5,000 to keep the office open. Very few people know that. Personally, not to AA. And that's lucky. It would have spoiled, ruined AA. Bill wanted to open a hospital. There's a funny combination. Dr. Bob was a very conservative, spiritual, withdrawn man. As long as he lived, he went to a meeting every week in the King Street School in Akron and sat in the same chair. And if you went in there early and sat in that chair, don't sit there. That's Dr. Bob's chair. And he's assured a co-founder, a wonderful man. And Bill Wilson was just the opposite. You know, if it hadn't been AA, he'd been selling snake oil. He'd just tell you what I'm going to do. Got another book here. Get those dollars rolling and keep us on the air, folks. But the combination, they were a great balance. They were a great balance wheel. They always said if Bill Wilson had been the only starter of AA, AA would have sold out by 1937. If Dr. Bob had been the only founder, he'd never really would have got off his block in Akron, Ohio. There'd be a lot of people sober, but all in that one block.
Oh, yes, sir.
But the two of them acted as a balance wheel, and they were very human. And like you find in AA today, it's a funny thing. Their followers fought incessantly, because they had different ways of doing it. Dr. Bob was more into the Oxford approach, four absolutes, more spiritual. Bill was more into the action, do it. And they got along, but their followers shook their fists. You're full of shit! And fight and terrible things and wouldn't talk. And these two guys got along well, but their followers were terrible. AA even then had the same basic terrible flaw it has today. And the basic terrible flaw of AA is that it's full of alcoholics. And we're all looking in to see what we can do about that. There are some groups that have already changed it. But they got this book going. 1940. 1939 and 40, there was a catcher for the Cleveland Indians named Raleigh Helmsley. And he was kind of famous because he was Bob Feller's catcher. And Bob Feller was the best-known pitcher of that day for the Cleveland Indians. And he was about out of the team, and some AAs got him, sent him to Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob sobered him up. They got him back. And they interviewed him one day and said, "So what? How did you come back in the big leagues?" He said, "I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's wonderful." And they got a big play in the Cleveland paper. And everybody was thrilled by it. All the AAs were. "This is great." And in fact, Dr. Bill got the, "Hey, look how good it did in Cleveland to get some faces in the paper." And he took a tour of several cities. And the first thing he did in every city was call the newspaper men in, have his picture taken, be interviewed, tell them about AA, go on to the next city, have his picture taken, on and on. And after about 8 months of that, he was within a 1/16 of an inch of getting drunk. And he didn't know why. Just terribly, terribly depressed. He couldn't understand why. And an old guy, an old minister named Reverend Sam Shoemaker came to call on him because he'd heard about him. And they talked about it. And this guy was an alcoholic. He said, "You know, it sounds to me like whatever you had going before, you better start doing that again." And it said, Bill later wrote, that literally saved his life. If Bill Wilson would have gone down in 1940, you and I would be down in 1985, I'll tell you. And you might think about that, because that and ensuing events was the reason for anonymity, because he watched how even to him, how personalities get ahead of anything you're selling. Give me more juice. I believe implicitly in anonymity. Most of you know, I get a lot of ink, and I'm on television a lot, and I have articles about me in magazine because of my work. And sometimes I get letters saying, I got a letter from this article in the Reader's Digest, several letters from around the country saying, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself. You're supposed to remain anonymous and you're selling this." And I had to write back and tell them, "No, you don't remain anonymous as a human being. You remain anonymous as a member of AA. Nothing that I know of has ever appeared publicly about me has ever said I was an AA. And I'd love to say it. I'd love it. Because how else do you explain anything so wonderful? But you don't do it, because when you start peddling AA, you become bigger than AA and you're doing them a favor." A few years ago, there was a book called I'll Cry, because she'd become such a celebrity, there was no sense going to those little amateurs for help anymore. And she wound up terrible. Too Much Too Soon, you may remember that book, the story of Diana Barrymore. At the end of it, she said, "I'm a member of Alcoholics now, Alcoholics Anonymous. They've come to see me. I go to their little meetings once in a while. But some of my real friends have told me if I just have wine with dinner, it'll be all right." And that's the end of the book. And a year later, she was dead in delirium tremens. There's always a reason. But anyway, they published the book. Let me tell you something funny. They got the book done, and they couldn't believe it was a small book. They couldn't see if they could get that much money for it. And they wanted to make it look like their money's worth. You know why this book is so thick? They took the thickest paper available and printed on that thick paper so these boobs would think they were getting something. True story. That's why in the current editions we have 3 and 4 sets of stories in the back. Because those 164 pages don't look like a book. But that's how many pages there are. Just 164. The rest of it is all stories and appendixes or appendices. And this series of coincidences continue to build. And by 1949, a lot of people were at odds with each other, and Bill and Dr. Bob thought it'd be a good idea to get them all together, see if they could. And they had these traditions. Based on people who had died, they wrote these traditions. These traditions are not some spiritual enforcer. They took examples of the guy in Florida who was selling AA memberships, of the guys who were breaking the anonymity concepts, the people who were putting principles sat down in order to get the juice. All of the principles embodied in the 12 traditions are based upon somebody doing it wrong and dying. So they got these 12 traditions over a period of years, and they wrote them in the late 1940s. that they're going to have the first international convention of AA for this organization. 15 years it's been going, and we're going good. The article in the Reader's Digest in 1941, you've all heard of that, I'm sure. Some of you may not be aware how that happened to be written. They took a reporter who had just exposed the Jersey racket, and they planted him in AA to expose AA, because they thought this was another racket. And he became convinced it wasn't, and wrote, his name was Jack Alexander, wrote a book completely opposite to what he came for, a story that he came in there to write. So 1950, they're going to have an international convention, get together and talk about these traditions and live in love. And they almost didn't have it. Dr. Bob's followers said, Akron! Bill Wilson's followers said, New York! And people got drunk or died over there. Funny, except for them, it wasn't very funny, but it was funny for you and me. So they finally just settled on Cleveland as a compromise. And they went, pardon me, they went to Cleveland. I've heard this very interesting, listening to those meetings in Cleveland, listening to guys get up and take a tradition and explain why they think we should vote for it. At the end of that, they voted these 12 traditions in. And Dr. Bob gave his very famous last talk. He was dying of cancer by this time. He had to be carried onto the stage. And he stood up here, and he was feeble, and he said, you know, boys and girls, I'm so glad to see you all here from all over the world, and hope you'll go back and tell the boys and girls back home about this. And most of you read that book, talk, and I can't quote it. But he said, it all boils, wound up with this. He said, it all winds up with this. In its last analysis, AA is just love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. So never be too busy to stop and give a pat on the back to the man behind you, like the man who ahead of you did for you. And tears, and he sat down. And Bill visited him the next month at his home. And as Bill was leaving, Dr. Bob said, the last great famous thing, he said, Bill, last words you ever said to Bill, don't let him louse it up. Don't let him louse it up. Keep it simple. Don't let him louse it up. And that has been the continuing story of AA. Bill Wilson, in his later years, didn't have a balance wheel anymore. And he got into a difficult situation. Series of them. When Bill was 10 years sober, he went through a syndrome some of you may have gone through if you've been sober a while. You will notice that sometimes after your first birthday, after your fifth birthday, after your 10th birthday, the decimal birthdays, there's a downer. And it always takes you by surprise. But it makes you think, Jesus, is this all there is? Or there should be more than this? Or I thought when I was 10 years sober, better than this. He didn't have anybody else 10 years sober. So he thought maybe AA only worked 10 years. And one of his friends sent him to a psychiatrist. And we went into psychoanalysis for the next 10 years. And he stayed in that depression for the next 10 years. Thank God AA was functioning around him, because he was doing the things, but he was just always depressed. He came out here in 1949 and talked privately to people, saying, I just can't shake this depression. At 20 years, he felt terrible. Some of his friends said, Bill, whatever it is you're doing, it isn't working. Maybe you ought to go back to keep it simple again and do the things you did in 1930. He said, okay. And he did it, and his depression lifted, and that was the end of that. But he was a moody man. And he had one great problem that none of us will ever have to face. There was nobody ahead of him who had ever done it before, and he always, as a this enthusiasm bubbling, he wanted to find out there must be more to do. So he became a sitting duck for quacks who tried to sell him things that would be helpful to alcoholics. In the mid-1950s, some doctors from Saskatchewan got him to try LSD because they thought that would be a cure for alcoholism. Now, that sounds funny, but in 1958, they had a treatment at UCLA for alcoholics of LSD. Nobody's ever heard of it. They came to the AA club, asked for volunteers. I volunteered, you know. I didn't want the treatment, but I wanted to get out of that abandoned car I was living in. And they wouldn't take me. I didn't look good enough for their goddamn test. But most of the people who took that treatment are dead now and were crazy. And on and on. But he was out there in the front. I never begrudged that guy anything. I never begrudged that guy any error. He made a lot of mistakes. In fact, in the early 1950s, he wrote a very touching letter that very few people know about. A number of people had become disillusioned by Big Deal Bill Wilson. And they pointed out in 8A his imperfections and his failures and his faults. And he wrote this letter to one of these guys that almost brings tears to your eyes. He said, I know how you feel. He said, but remember, I never said I was without error. As hard as it is for you to remember, and sometimes we remember, I'm just another drunk trying to get well, and I never will become wonderful. That's what makes AA different from the Oxford movement. There, they became well. Here, we continue to work to become well. And he said, you will always be disillusioned because no human being can rise to the limits that we impose on other people. What's amazing is not that they have fault, but that the people with that many faults do as well as they do. That's the touching part of AA then and now. There isn't a person that ever came to AA who hasn't been disillusioned by their sponsor eventually or by the people ahead of them. You're not perfect. Therefore, you're a phony. That happened to me. Happened to a lot of people. And then you have to mature a while to realize, isn't it amazing that people with all their problems, that they're doing as well as they are? That my sponsor did as well as he did with the faults he had. And I cherished him even more. But it's kind of a series of weird conditions that nowhere in the history of mankind have this many alcoholics been sober in one room except in AA. You stop and think about it. I'm not talking about AA in Los Angeles. I'm talking about this room. If the people in this room were all the only AAs that ever stayed sober, this would still be one of the greatest medical miracles of the 20th century. And it boils down to one thing. Every piece of early literature and later literature and knowledgeable literature about why this works gets down to this. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. You know, there was a movement that kept a lot of people sober. In 1840, it was started by a group of drinkers in Baltimore. They had premises not too dissimilar from AA. And they called it the Washingtonian Movement. And it caught on like wildfire. And in 5 years, they had hundreds of thousands of people sober. And they were so thrilled by what they were doing, they wanted to help everybody. So they took in all sorts of people with all sorts of problems. And they got bickering of whose problem was worse, this, that. And by 1848, there was nobody sober, 8 years after it started. The last, only gasp history. And the reason that's important for you and I to remember on AA's 50th anniversary, we hear a lot of harangues from people who aren't familiar with this. And they say things like, what do you mean narcotics addicts can't participate in AA? They have a problem. What do you mean compulsive eaters can't come to AA and participate? We have a problem. What do you mean Al-Anons can't be in closed meetings? They're married to alcoholics. I'm going to tell you something. If well-meaning people kept you sober, there's never been a shortage of well-meaning people. If people with problems could keep you sober, that's what killed the Oxford movement, because nobody had the same problem, and the people who got together, they threw them out. That's what killed the Washingtonian. The only thing that differentiates Alcoholics Anonymous from all other therapies that have ever tried to treat AA, this is the only one that is always boiled down to one alcoholic talking to another. We are not putting down addicts. We are not putting down gamblers and compulsive eaters. But the only thing that makes this work is one talking to another. That's why they founded Narcotics Anonymous, for one talking to another. That's why they founded Overeaters Anonymous, for one overeater talking to another. People can relate. Certainly anybody can come to our open meetings, but in closed meetings, it is one alcoholic talking to another. It has nothing to do with pride or ego or degradation. It is the only goddamn thing that makes this thing work. And don't give your life proving that you're right in some other futile little stupid thing when you know what the hell you're talking about. And we all got to remember that, because that's what AA is about. We're not better than or lesser than. We are alcoholics, one alcoholic talking to another. You could be a narcotic addict as long as one of your problems is drinking. You can be a compulsive eater if you're a drinker. But you must be one alcoholic talking to another, or you got no business. It has nothing to do with anything else, does it? All of the so-called rules we have are not whims made by some autocrat in New York. People have given their lives to show that they belong there. People have died to make these points. That's what's kind of sad today. There seems to be a little movement in some groups. I'm not putting them down because I don't think they know what they're doing. But after the coffee break, they read the traditions, and it's considered not very slick to sit down and stop talking till the traditions are over. People are always coming in, and I'll tell you, I know people in groups that haven't heard the first five or six traditions, been going there for 6 months, because it's considered beneath their... It's kind of slick not to listen to traditions. They have no idea. Those traditions are based on the lives of people just like them who didn't know any better and died as a result of it. They are not... There's something you ought to listen to. In our group, we read the long form of the traditions, one a month. If you ever want to understand the traditions, in the back of the book, that's the original form of the traditions, is the long form. The short form that we read is just something they just condense. The real traditions are the long form of the traditions. Read them sometime and you will understand what AA is trying to do. We're not trying to put anybody down or ourselves down. But it's an amazing series of coincidences. That Episcopalian minister in 1912 and that poor Roland stumbling into Dr. Jung in 1930 and happened to be up in Vermont when this goof Ebby runs his car into somebody's house. And a year, some months later, happened to remember, Bill Wilson's here in New York. And Bill Wilson standing in a goddamn lobby in the Mayflower Hotel, literally ready to forget it, and deciding by the 51 to 49 vote in his head, I'm sure, to make that 10th call. I don't know if I'd have made it. I don't know if you'd have made it. We can thank God he made it. And getting a hold of that drunken doctor who happened to just be coming off a drunk, so he was full of remorse and able to start. This is a wonderful organization. It's a paradox. It is not a social club, but yet it is a social club. It really is a great social club, but that isn't its purpose. It is not a place to go and find friends, but it is a place to go and find friends. It isn't a place to hide out in, but it is a place to hide out in sometimes. What it is, it's a remarkable situation. It is a microscopic slice of humanity where you learn about life, all kinds of people, places, and things. And learn about the emotions of alcoholism. And learn your mortal difference. That alcohol does something more for you than it does for other people. That's why you can't drink. Not because it's morally bad, as the Oxford movement said. Not because it's evil, like the church said. But because someone here was lucky enough to find out, alcohol alters my perception of reality and it doesn't do that for other people. And so we have to keep that in mind. That's why we keep going to meetings. I haven't heard anything new in an AA meeting in 20-some years, I don't think. But I never leave a meeting without feeling better than I came in. Because one of the reasons for AA is sober up, to reinforce what I already know. To remember that the world does not end in my head. There's a power greater than myself. There are sponsors. There are people ahead of me. There's people with examples. I screw up again and again and again. I don't have to commit suicide or get drunk. I have to get up and say, God damn it, I'm going to try to do that better. One great advantage I've always thought about, most people make New Year's Eve resolutions. Some of them last till 3 in the afternoon on New Year's Day. Some, if they're lucky, will last a month. Every night in your life and mine is New Year's Eve. And every day is New Year's. And every night of my life, if I remember and choose to, I can resolve how I'm going to make it do it better tomorrow. I may not last till 10 o'clock in the morning. But that doesn't mean the year is over. I have to wait till next year. I have to wait till next time and try it again. We are very fortunate. We have a tendency to take this cake and things for granted. I do. I suppose you do. But we are really frightfully fortunate. And as you stay sober longer, the sense of your good fortune will continue. I see alcoholics die every day, and I think to myself, that's where I would be if I ever took AA for granted a couple days too long. And it's happened to many, many people. The guy that taught me that died drunk because he rose above AA's petty little restrictions. I am very glad to be here tonight. We're going to have some music and a dance and fun, I guess. But I think it would be indeed remiss if we didn't indeed say happy birthday to this organization, to that moment when old Dr. Bob took his bottle of beer and his shaking hand and drank it so he could do the surgery. and in doing the surgery got the feeling he might be able to stay sober, and they carried a message to someone else. A lot of people gave their lives so that you and I can sit here today. We don't want to take it for granted. Happy birthday.